What do you know? What do you know? What do you know?
The birds and the bees got wise to the lies.
What do you know?
So they took to the trees and took to the skies.
What do you know?
On top of the chain and safe from the rain.
What do you know?
What you know about the ways of the underside?
What do you know?
I bought a hot shot gun for my little Van Guinea.
What do you know?
'Cause they're hip to the bone and hip to the right.
What do you know?
And I'm hip with your ass 'cause you ain't got a penny.
What do you know?
What you know about the ways on the underside?
What do you know?
Got a hot shot cat from a North Bank Guinea.
What do you know?
Penny up with your ass 'cause you ain't got a penny.
What do you know?
Drop rocks from above, cut you all down to size.
What do you know?
'Cause I hip to the ball and the hip to the lies.
What do you know?
And what do you know? And that was Maynard's Pussifer. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 87. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. And this episode is titled Gaza. An interview with Dr. Norman Finkelstein and is being released on Friday, August 13, 2010. My interview with Dr. Norman Finkelstein was recorded on Friday, August 13, 2010. Today is Friday the 13th. And we talk about Israel, Palestine, and Gaza, and the Holocaust industry with Dr. Norman Finkelstein. And Norman received his doctorate in 1988 from the Department of Politics at Princeton University. For many years, he taught political theory and the Israel-Palestine conflict. He is currently an independent scholar. Finkelstein is the author of 6 books, his latest, Gaza, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion, and about 5 others, which have been translated into more than 40 foreign editions, including Beyond Chutzpah, The Misuse of Antisemitism and the Abuse of History, and The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, Image and Reality in the Israel-Palestine Conflict, A Nation on Trial, The Goldhagen Thesis and Historical Truth, and The Rise and Fall of Palestine, A Personal Account of the Infantata Years and Upcoming, A Farewell to Israel, The Coming Breakup of American Zionism. And you can visit him at www.normanfinkelstein.com. Donations. This week, my love and thanks goes out to Patrick, Brian, Mark, Kim, Sam, Robert, Paul, Randy, and Dr. Craig. This show is dedicated to all of you guys, and thanks for making it happen. And as I said last week, last month was the toughest ever, and I really appreciate everyone who stepped up and helped to make this episode happen, as well as last week's, and it's been a real struggle lately. This show is run mostly on donations and our meager website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the audio archives, you help to continue this programming. Without you, we wouldn't be here. And we could really use an executive producer, as I mentioned last week. If you know anyone who has money and wants to put it to good use, we have a couple of video projects in mind. And if you can help with transcripts, I still have 2 left, I believe, Rick Simpson and Dave Nichols. If you can help with those, please email me. Upcoming shows. And regarding the upcoming shows, last week I mentioned that due to the stressful times and other issues, I've been unable to stick to the weekly schedule. And as well, we've completed nearly 50 of the interviews on psychedelics and entheogens that we were planning on getting done, so we will be shifting gears with the show over the next couple of months and going towards a more trivium education-based show, since that is the most pertinent issue right now. And as I mentioned last week, frankly, the psychedelics don't work properly without the proper education and critical thinking. And without critical thinking, people, after a full-blown psychedelic experience, can fall into too many traps, like various New Age traps and cults and 2012 and all kinds of stuff. So anyway, we have to apply the trivium and the quadrivium before we go that direction. But anyway, I still have Dr. Marguerite Rigliozzo scheduled to come back, as well as Hank Alberelli and Professor Bart Dean and a few others. I've still not been able to get a final confirmation from Carolyn Garcia, so I'll let everybody know as soon as I know. And we'll still be putting out the MAPS episodes. I will do my best to get one out this weekend. And you can support this program by going to the Gnostic Media website at www.gnosticmedia.com and order one of the books, DVDs, She Who Remembers Archives, T-shirts, or make a donation. We greatly appreciate your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Would you like to start out with telling us a little bit about who is Dr. Norman Finkelstein?
Mm-hmm. I was born in 1953, December 8th, in Brooklyn, pretty much. And I grew up pretty close to where I live now. I grew up first in Borough Park, which at the time was a mixed working class neighborhood. Now it's a Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. Then we moved to a upwardly mobile lower middle class neighborhood called Mill Basin, also in Brooklyn. And that was my home base until I went off to college, then graduate school, went out on my own. And then when my parents passed away, we sold the house, and I now live in Ocean Parkway, Brooklyn, and I taught for most of my life, and I'm currently unemployed.
What is your educational background?
I went to a state university in upstate New York called Binghamton University, and then I went to Princeton University for graduate work. And then I studied at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris.
And your family was Holocaust survivors?
Both my parents were in the concentration camps. My mother, both of them were in the Warsaw Ghetto from September 39 till April 1943, when the ghetto uprising was put down. The survivors of the uprising, about 30,000, they estimate, were all deported to Majdanek concentration camp. And my mother was in Majdanek and then subsequently in two slave labor camps. My father was in Majdanek, then Auschwitz concentration camp, and he was in the Auschwitz death march. And then they met in DP, Displaced People Camp, in Linz, Austria, after the war, and came over here in 1949.
How did you get involved in studying Gaza, the Bolshevik Revolution, and, as you put it, the Holocaust industry?
I was a person of the left in my youth, and being of the left meant having a point of view on the Russian Revolution. So I studied it quite intensely, and actually that was my initial field of study in graduate school. I was, for a formative period in my youth, I was a Maoist, which meant a follower of Chairman Mao. After Mao Zedong died, I guess, 1977, the whole Maoist enterprise basically collapsed. And I was, at that point, politically unaffiliated. in June 82, Israel invaded Lebanon. It was the first time I was actively involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And then I decided to write my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation, on the theory of Zionism. And the conflict never ended, so I ended up consuming my life.
You've been called an anti-Semite and a Holocaust denier. What can you say about these ad hominem attacks against you?
I have nothing to say about them. They're meaningless, and I have nothing to say about them.
Please talk about your book, The Holocaust Industry, and the basic premise behind that book.
Well, I wrote the book after my parents' death. My parents passed away in 1995, and it did begin to grate on me how the Nazi Holocaust was being used for political purposes, and also it had become, in those years, a shakedown racket. Was being used to extract monies from Europe in the name of what were called needy Holocaust victims. The pretext for extracting the monies, for example, from the Swiss banks were completely fraudulent. And once the monies were extracted, and the monies were quite significant, though we'll never know how much, but it was certainly in the many billions of dollars, the actual survivors, the actual victims, never saw or saw barely a cent of those monies. It was basically pocketed by crooked Jewish organizations and crooked Jewish leaders, many of whom ended up in scandal. Probably about a half dozen of the major figures from the Holocaust compensation racket ended up in some form of scandal. Some were sent to jail. Some were attacked in editorial pages for thievery. In any event, a large part of the book, The Holocaust Industry, was devoted to exposing these Holocaust hucksters, and the other part was devoted to showing how the Nazi Holocaust was being used as an ideological weapon to deflect criticism of Israeli policy.
Now, some have accused you of using false rhetoric to support your claims. Is that true, or are you using factual reports?
I don't know what it means to say I use false rhetoric. If it's if a word accurately describes what people are doing, then it seems to me perfectly justified to use that word. So, for example, when the world's leading authority on the Nazi Holocaust, the late Raoul Hilberg, when he was asked in 1999 about the Holocaust, the demands being made on the Swiss banks for Holocaust compensation, he said, and now I'm quoting him, "For the first time in history, Jews are using the blackmail weapon." So he called it blackmail. I called it extortion. And those words accurately depicted what was going on.
And Raoul Hilberg supported your book, The Holocaust Industry, didn't he?
Yeah, he was the only, actually, to my knowledge, he was the only one who supported it. There were some reasonable comments from places like The Economist, but Hilberg knew the historical record very well. Others were just journalistic commentaries. And he knew the record well, and he knew what I was writing was true.
Would you say that this extortion against European countries is still happening today?
No, actually it's not, because it was mostly a trade-off. The head of the World Jewish Congress is this crook named Edgar Bronfman, His sidekick was a guy named Rabbi Israel Singer. And Bronfman was one of the chief contributors to the Democratic Party. And there was a kind of quid pro quo with the Clinton administration that if we give you money, you'll support our Holocaust compensation racket. So it was, and so Clinton then appointed this guy, Stuart Eisenstadt. He was the special Jewish representative to the Jewish community, a complete thug. And it was basically a Clinton-era thing, because the Holocaust compensation racket wouldn't have gotten to square one if it hadn't had the backing of the Clinton administration. Once the Clinton administration left office and was replaced by the Bush administration, it was all over. Plus, many of the figures were discredited. As I said, a lot of them ended up in jail or in various difficulties. The main figure was this absolutely repellent character named Rabbi Israel Singer. And it turned out that as he was denouncing secret Swiss bank accounts, he himself had opened up a secret Swiss bank account and was taking money out of the World Jewish Congress and putting it in the bank account. He has since disappeared.
Wow. Your latest book is called This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. What got you started writing this book, and why a book on Gaza?
I knew that the record would be completely forgotten and completely rewritten, and I felt that what those people endured deserved at least to be remembered and accurately represented. And I was, you know, the prediction was of course correct. Mine was the only book written on what happened in Gaza. And now when you read the accounts, the retrospective accounts, they're all completely falsified, you know, these claims that the Israel invaded Gaza because of the Hamas rocket attacks. You know, complete nonsense. There was a ceasefire in place, began June 17th, 2008, and it ended November 4th, 2008. And the Israelis themselves acknowledge, and I'm quoting them, that Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel broke it on November 4th, an hour election day, because it waited until everybody's attention here was riveted on the results of the historic, riveted to the results of the historic election. And then they wanted to break the ceasefire, and they wanted the rocket attacks as a pretext to invade Gaza. And so on November 4th, they went in, killed six Palestinian militants, knowing full well that the ceasefire would break down. But now when you read the accounts, it's Israel invade Gaza to put an end to the Hamas rocket attacks. If Israel didn't want the Hamas rocket attacks, why did it invade Gaza and trigger those rocket attacks? I mean, it's just complete lies. And I knew it would happen. And so I decided to make sure that there would be at least one accurate record of what happened.
I have a friend who lives in Israel, and his friend lives right on the border of Gaza, and he's always telling me of all of these horror stories about how the Gazans are always launching rockets against his friend's town. What do you have to say about claims like that?
Well, there were rocket attacks. I mean, I'm not going to... First of all, we have to be careful about the use of the word rocket, because it conjures up some sort of Polaris missile or something. If you take the case of the whole Gaza, during the whole Gaza massacre between December 27th and January 18th, I'm not going to trivialize it, but the fact simply is there were three Israeli civilians killed. In terms of damage to infrastructure, there was one house that was nearly destroyed. These rockets are basically firecrackers and Roman candles. There's probably more danger on the 4th of July in Washington Heights, where I used to live, than from these rockets and mortar attacks. You know, you don't want them to happen, obviously, and you'd prefer that they were not to happen, obviously. But then there's an easy way to avert it. Let Israel withdraw to its legal borders and stop occupying and tormenting and torturing the people.
What is Israel's justification for controlling Gaza and the West Bank, and what are the threats claimed by Israel in order to justify their actions against Gaza?
Well, actually, I have no idea any longer. I don't think Israelis any longer know why they're occupying the territory, apart from the fact that they want it. You can't make any claims any longer about these being security assets in an era of long-range missiles, where Israel claims Iran poses a threat, where Israel claims that Hezbollah poses a threat, where Israel claims that Syria poses a threat. And all of these cases, they claim that the threats are being posed by missiles. So if it's missile technology which is posing a security threat, how can it possibly be the case that controlling these pieces of territory can be a significant security asset for Israel? Israel keeps the territory because, like most conquering states, it doesn't want to give it up unless it's forced to.
What actions has Israel taken against Palestine and Gaza in the last 50 years?
Well, Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza, as well as the Assyrian Golan Heights and the Egyptian Sinai. It occupied them in June 1967. It's now been approximately 43 years. And the course of those 43 years, they've basically shredded the social fabric, wrecked the economy, and destroyed the lives of the Palestinians living under that occupation. It's the longest occupation in the modern world.
What can you tell us about the assassination of Arafat and the PLO for Israeli political control?
I don't know if Arafat was assassinated. I know there are rumors to that effect, and it's always possible. But I don't think there's been any definite evidence shown. And I don't think it would be morally a significant act, but I don't think politically it was a significant act, because I don't think it significantly changed the picture from September 1993. When the Oslo Agreement was signed, the Palestinians were basically acting as collaborators for Israel. That was their purpose. Israel needed a collaborator for subcontractors in order to enforce the occupation. That was the role that the PLO was playing. Arafat himself was somewhat more recalcitrant than the other members of the PLO, and Israel was no doubt glad to be rid of him, and maybe was involved in his assassination, involved in his death, but I have no idea.
Can you tell us anything about the natural gas reserves off the coast of Gaza that Professor Michel Chosedovsky has discussed?
You know, I'm sure they're a factor in Israeli calculation, but I don't think they're the key factor. They are. Right now, there's some litigation going on with Lebanon over those natural gas deposits, and probably, you know, there's some calculation with regard to Gaza, but I don't think that's the primary motive behind Israeli policy.
What is the average age of people living in Gaza?
Right now, half the population is 16 years old or under.
That's significant. Talk about the 2000 Camp David talks and what transpired there.
The head of the Palestinian at that time, Yasser Arafat, President Clinton, and Ehud Barak met in Camp David in, it's funny now, I can't remember if it was June or July 2000, I guess it was, well, it was either June or July 2000, and they negotiated. The bottom line is the chief negotiator for the Israelis, or one of the chief negotiators, Shlomo Ben-Ami, when he was asked his opinion of the last offer the Israelis, that Barak made at Camp David, he said, if I were a Palestinian, I wouldn't have accepted what was offered at Camp David. And then the talks went on intermittently behind the scenes until December, when President Clinton presented what were called his parameters for resolving the conflict. Both sides accepted the parameters with qualifications. There were reservations, it was called, on both sides. And then negotiations resumed in January 2001 in Taba. The negotiators said at the end of these negotiations that they never came closer to an agreement, but at the last minute, Ehud Barak withdrew his representative at the negotiations, and they ended.
Can you tell us about the use of white phosphorus?
Israel has used white phosphorus in many, I can't say, in all of its wars. I actually became involved, as I said, in the Israel-Palestine conflict in 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon. And already back then, Israel was using white phosphorus in its as part of its weapons arsenal against, at that point, it was Lebanese and Palestinians. White phosphorus, it reaches a temperature of 816 degrees Celsius, 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And Israel dropped it during the, or fired it during the Gaza massacre. It fired it on a school, on a marketplace, on a humanitarian warehouse, and it fired it on two hospitals, Al-Quds Hospital and Al-Wafa Hospital, and it fired it on civilian areas in Gaza.
Tell us about your recent trip to Gaza.
Well, it's not so recent anymore. I was there about, I don't even remember, it was probably about a year ago or more, I guess. I was in Gaza. I wasn't there long. It was about a week's time, maybe even less. I can't recall right now. And I can't say I was surprised by the devastation, because I've seen Israel's calling card already several times. So even though people who were new to it were quite appalled by the magnitude of the devastation, I actually was not. I spent some time meeting with Hamas representatives. I did not meet with the leadership, but I met with people who are in, they were in positions that I guess you can call, they were in responsible positions, official positions, and talked to them about my own point of view of what was the most effective way to proceed politically.
Are the Palestinians as evil as some would like us to believe?
Oh, actually, literally nobody who's actually gone over and lived there has ever said that. Obviously, there have been many people who have gone over. Everybody, including the Goldstone, including Richard Goldstone himself, paid tribute to the generosity and the decency of the people he met.
And you're Jewish. Did you ever feel threatened in Palestine?
Yeah, I felt very threatened by the Israeli soldiers, because everybody who goes over the threat comes from the occupying army. Now things have probably changed somewhat in the West Bank. I've not been there, but the main threat seems to be coming now from the, well, there's obviously the big threat that comes from the settlers, and then there's a big threat that now comes from the Palestinian security forces. But for the Palestinians themselves, actually, no, I never. There was one tiny period where maybe 1995, 96, when Hamas was just beginning to have a visible, a palpable presence in the West Bank, that there was, for a brief moment, there was some concern about my safety. But apart from that, no, I never had any problems. And everyone knew I was Jewish.
Tell us about Israeli war crimes.
Oh, well, the Goldstone report, the report that was commissioned by the United Nations and led by a respected international jurist, a South African who also happens to be Jewish and a Zionist. The Goldstone report that Israel concluded that Israel used deliberately disproportionate power, deliberately disproportionate force to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population, and conclude that Israel committed multiple war crimes, including the wanton destruction of civilian infrastructure, the destruction of flour mill, chicken farms, water and sewage infrastructure, and the targeting of civilians. And also the mistreatment of prisoners, the torture of prisoners, the terrorization of prisoners. So all told, it found that Israel had committed multiple war crimes in Gaza, and that's just not unusual. The same thing can be said for what Israel did in Lebanon in the summer of 2006, July, August 2006. It's, as I said, that's Israel's calling card.
We can only be fair to talk about Hamas war crimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Goldstone report concluded that, like Israel, Hamas was guilty of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. But that has to obviously be seen within two contexts. First of all, it's the relative context. Israel killed 1,400 Palestinians, of whom 1,000 to 1,200 were civilians. Hamas killed 13 Israelis, of whom 3 were civilians. I should say, Hamas, 13 Israelis were killed, of whom 3 were civilians, 10 were combatants, and of the combatants, half of them were killed by other Israelis. So its ratio of deaths, it was more than 14 to 1. If you compare civilian deaths, it was a ratio, deaths all told, the ratio was 100 to 1. On civilians killed, the ratio was 400 to 1. So this is plainly not a war. This is a massacre that occurred in Gaza. If you take destruction, infrastructure, civilian infrastructure that was destroyed in the case of Palestinians, 6,000 homes were destroyed or almost completely destroyed. In the case of Israel, it was one home that was nearly destroyed. So there you have a ratio of 6,000 to 1. So you have to see it in that context of relative destruction. And then the other context is that Palestinians have been living under a brutal occupation for 43 years. And at some point they have the right to resist that occupation, especially when the occupation at the point where the Palestinians finally resisted. The Palestinians' leadership in Gaza was saying, we're willing to accept the ceasefire, but there has to be this quid pro quo. And the quid pro quo was Israel had imposed a brutal siege in Gaza, which Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they all called a flagrant violation of international law because it was a form of collective punishment. The Goldstone Report said it was a possible crime against humanity. So the Palestinians said, we're willing to accept the ceasefire, but you have to lift this brutal siege of Gaza. But Israel refused to lift the siege. And at that point, December 2008, people like Sarah Roy of Harvard, the world's leading authority in the Gaza economy, she said the breakdown of an entire society is occurring and the international community is doing nothing. Mary Robinson, the former High Commissioner for Human Rights, she went to Gaza and she said that a civilization is being destroyed. And you have to ask the obvious question, what were the people of Gaza supposed to do?
Talk about the Anti-Defamation League. What is their purpose? Who is Foxman? And why does the ADL continually use so much false rhetoric to support their claims?
Well, the chief purpose of the Anti-Defamation League has been to defame people who criticize Israeli policy. Abraham Foxman is a complete thug. One of the curiosities, I have to say, is he goes from one scandal to the next, but he doesn't affect his reputation or the reputation of the ADL. They keep describing it as a civil rights organization. It has as much to do with civil rights as the Sylvia Peace Committee used to have on peace, and but it doesn't.
It sounds like some Orwellian doublespeak.
He's a kind of freakish character, and honestly, he's a perplexity, but he continues to be cited. Respected civil rights organization. Who on God's earth respects the ADL? I have no idea.
Recently, there was a filmmaker who managed to get inside the ADL, and he did a documentary that you were featured in, I believe, called Defamation. Would you like to talk about that?
I didn't see the documentary. I was not pleased with what I heard about it, but I didn't actually see it.
I thought he did a pretty good job at revealing Foxman's trickery.
I have no idea. You know, I didn't see it, but I was the reports I heard, I was not happy with. I felt I was used.
Understood. Some claim that Israel is behind the New World Order. Is there any meaning to that?
I have no idea what the New World Order is. I mean, these terms are just complete insanity, so far as I can tell.
Well, there's a very good book by Professor Carol Quigley that's called Tragedy and Hope that goes into much of those concepts. How do Americans view Israel, and what factions of Americans support Israel?
There's no question that there's been a serious decline in American Jewish support of Israel, mostly among the younger generation. And that's for fairly straightforward reasons. Most Jews are liberal. 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama in the last election. And being liberal means you support human rights, you support peace, you support the rule of law, and on all those counts, you support tolerance, equality before the law. And on all those counts, Israeli policy has become indefensible for those who call themselves liberal, and especially among the younger generations, under 30, under 40, There's been what the Jewish literature calls the distancing from Israel. As to Israel's support, it comes mostly from the older generation, you would say roughly 55 and older, and also from of the older, it's concentrated, I should say, broad, across the age spectrum. The support is concentrated among Orthodox Jews. So you have Orthodox Jews and older Jews. And then there's, you know, a smattering of support among what are called evangelical Christians.
Please comment on your remarks in your book where you say, quote, if another flare-up in the region similar to the Gaza operation will probably lead to an even more severe outbreak of anti-Semitic activity against communities worldwide, then the efficacious method to fight anti-Semitism would appear to be for Israel to stop committing massacres.
Yeah, well, if you look at the data, they always say there's a very precise correlation between Israel's launching of wars of aggression and outbreaks of what they call anti-Semitism. So if you look at the main quote-unquote outbreaks, they occurred in 2002 when Israel launched Operation Defensive Shield and killed many Palestinians in the West Bank. Then there was another outbreak, they say, in 2006 when Israel attacked Lebanon. Then there was another outbreak, they say, when Israel invaded Gaza. So if you want to prevent these outbreaks, you know, expression prevention is the best form of cure. Then just don't commit massacres.
Talk about the use of rhetoric like anti-Semite and anti-Israel in order to quell dialogue that's critical of Israel.
Well, these are just epithets that are hurled at the messenger because the message can't be answered. They're no longer really very effective because it used to be just used against left-wing critics of Israel, but now that criticism of Israel has entered the mainstream, they're also being used against mainstream critics, but it doesn't work with mainstream critics because the mainstream critics are well-known quantities, people like Jimmy Carter, and whereas you can call this unknown person named Norman Finkelstein an anti-Semite, and it's believable because people don't know who the hell he is. But when you start calling someone like Jimmy Carter an anti-Semite, it's no longer believable. And then when you start calling someone like Richard Goldstone an anti-Semite, somebody who's a Jewish or Zionist and a well-known supporter of Israel, when you start calling him an anti-Semite, the term has lost its... It never had any validity, but now it's lost its edge.
As Professor Shlomo Sand states, that the word Semite is actually only related to the language group that includes Arabic Semitic languages.
Well, Semites refer to the Semitic language group. In the 19th century, there was a belief that language expressed race, that different language groups thought differently because language was an expression of the, it was a kind of, they didn't use the term, but it was a kind of genetic, it was genetically coded. And so it was easy to make the slide from Semitic languages to Semitic races. But when the term was coined, it was coined to refer to Jews, so I see no point in not in using it for anyone else except Jews. It's inaccurate, but black people aren't black, and white people aren't white, but the terms black and white were coined to refer to specific groups. They're not accurate terms, but that's the term that's used in the same way anti-Semitic was coined to refer to Jews.
Why were Jewish organizations so upset over the Goldstone statement to prosecute Jewish soldiers for war crimes?
Well, it didn't actually say to prosecute Jewish soldiers. It said to prosecute Israeli soldiers and Israeli officers and Israeli political leaders who were responsible for committing war crimes during the Gaza massacre. Well, they were upset for a very simple reason. It was very difficult to answer the Goldstone report because their usual tactics to call the messenger an anti-Semite, a Holocaust denier, a self-hating Jew, those tactics were not going to be very effective with Richard Goldstone. And so they were confronted with the horror of having to look at the facts.
Should Israeli soldiers who are guilty of war crimes be tried just as any other group of people, or is it because some Zionists think that they're above all other peoples that they consider justification for not having trials for Israeli war crimes?
No state wants to be prosecuted for war crimes. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the war in Vietnam, and the only major war crime, the only major trial that occurred during that, about 3 million Vietnamese were killed, about another 500,000 Cambodians were killed, and 500,000 Laotians were killed. The only case that any American remembers is the case of Lieutenant Calley, and Calley was for the My Lai massacre, and Calley was a relatively low-level personnel. The next person above him was a fellow named Captain Medina. He wasn't prosecuted, and forget about Westmoreland, Kissinger, and all the rest. So it's not altogether shocking that states resist prosecution for the commission of war crimes, and Israel resisted as well.
Do you think we'll ever see a war crimes tribunal against Israel?
Probably not. The U.S. will protect it.
Is it true then, rather than deal with the evidence presented in the Goldstone report, that the U.S. House of Representatives actually voted to dismiss it instead?
Yeah, they voted to dismiss it, but the resolution was completely flawed, as Goldstone himself demonstrated. He went through it paragraph by paragraph and said these are simply false statements for anybody who's actually read the report. But you can't really expect members of the House of Representatives to read the report. They just do what their donors told them to do.
Being of Jewish background yourself, do you find it ironic that the overall majority of persons who were bashing the Goldstone report were Zionists and or Jewish? And what do you have to say about that?
No, I don't find it ironic. They're mostly... they just do it because that's where the money comes from. In general, most people, obviously, you would guess 99.9% didn't read the report. It was a large report. It was 550 pages. And nobody who read it could walk away without feeling it was a pretty harrowing report. There were sections of it which are very memorable, actually. And
would you discuss those?
Well, there were the sections dealing with the treatment of prisoners, the taking of prisoners, putting them in ditches around the tanks, using them as human shields for the tanks, forcing the women and the men to defecate and urinate in these ditches. The torturing of them, it was pretty ghastly stuff, to tell you the truth. And then the destruction of the civilian infrastructure, taking over areas, having complete military control over them, and then for 3 days sending in bulldozers and people with detonating mines and systematically, methodically destroying home after home after home, systematically and methodically destroying bringing in tanks and rolling over chicken farms, killing 100,000 chickens. It was pretty ghastly. So nobody reading this stuff could fail to be moved by it. But these people don't read it. They go where the money is.
Why was the Palestinian Authority threatened if it did not rescind its support of the Goldstone Report?
The Palestinian Authority didn't want the Goldstone Report because the Goldstone Report would have legitimized Hamas, made it a party to the conflict, since Hamas was in charge of Gaza. And any legitimization of Hamas was anathema to the Palestinian Authority.
Talk about Ahmadinejad. Is he really an anti-Semite, or is he, as Naturi Karta has shown, only against Zionism?
Oh, I don't know what he is. He's a politician, and he's a demagogue, and he makes statements which are ambiguous enough that they can be interpreted as being anti-Semitic, and if you don't want to interpret them as anti-Semitic, then you don't interpret them as anti-Semitic. He's a politician. That's how he got reelected, and I don't attach much importance to what he says because there's no evidence whatsoever that Iran intends to attack Israel, and the Jewish community in Iran is treated fairly well. So I don't think these are important discussions, whether he's an anti-Semite or not.
What do you think is the most important method of bringing attention to Gaza and the suppression of the Palestinians there?
Well, I think the methods that were pioneered by the flotillas and other forms of nonviolent resistance have been quite successful. Obviously, the achievements are still very meager, but that's because it's still in the early stages. But I think the main lesson of the Mavi Marmara and other such nonviolent undertakings is that you should ignore states, ignore governments, and just rely on the initiative and the commitment of ordinary people, and if you want to affect change, in this case, if you want to end occupation of Gaza.
What is the single most important concept that you would like listeners to take away from this interview?
Well, I always say the same thing, as speaking as a resolute atheist. God helps those who help themselves. That if you want to see the world made a better place, don't rely on anyone. Don't look for messiahs. Don't look for people from up above. Don't look for people chanting insipid slogans like change. But rely on your own resources and rely on your own. Not on your own. You have to work with others. There's an old Union song that said, "Many pebbles form an arch. Singly, none. You have to work with others if you want to affect change. But that's the way to try to make the world a better place and not look for messiahs, white or black.
Would you like to give out your website, book titles, and any contact or other information you would like people to have?
You can get that off my website. It's www., and then my name, one word, normanfinkelstein.com. And the books, most of them will be listed on Amazon, except the last one. This time we went too far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion.
Why isn't your most recent book on Amazon?
I have an old friend who's trying a new publishing venture. And a new publishing venture is to attempt to bypass Amazon. Amazon takes about 50% of profits from the publisher, and so this new publishing venture basically is to bypass Amazon and use the money, which would normally have gone to Amazon, to use it for web-based advertising. I can't predict how this venture will work. I was like the first or second book, so it's still too early to tell whether it's possible to bypass Amazon.
Norman, thank you so much for your time this morning, and I appreciate you taking the time to be a part of this program.
You're welcome.
And best to you and yours.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.